From California to Vermont, New Jersey to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Senator Bernie Sanders is calling for forgiveness of all college loans and free college going forward. Mary Claire Amsalem of the Heritage Foundation is here to talk about why that is a very bad idea. President Trump has taken the latest step toward health care reform by requiring more transparency in pricing. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has a wide-ranging interview with U.S. Senator Ron Wyden as they talk about regulations on big tech and the possibility of war with Iran. And President Trump has hit on just the right combination of military saber-rattling and economic sanctions in dealing with Iran. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In his latest proposal designed to turn America into a socialist country, presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is proposing the federal government pay off all student loans and then make college free for everyone going forward. To discuss the pitfalls of this proposal, we turn to Mary Claire Amsalem, who is a policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. Mary Claire, welcome to American Radio Journal. Mary Claire, let's begin. Senator Bernie Sanders has put forth a plan that would absolve virtually all, if not all, college debt in this country. Tell us what the senator is proposing.
This week, Senator Sanders and Representative Ilhan Omar proposed a plan to eliminate all student loan debt in the United States, in addition to making public colleges, four-year colleges and two-year colleges, tuition-free in the United States. This is a massive proposal that he's proposed paying for with a tax on Wall Street trading, which would, of course, you know, be devastating to the economy at a time where I think more Americans are gaining confidence in the success of our stock market and the success of our economy. But free college in general and loan forgiveness are both bad policies. And at the end of the day, this will end up being a bailout to our universities who have already been taking advantage of the taxpayer dollars over the years. Simply giving them a blank check is not the way to improve many of the deeply rooted flaws in our higher education system.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes about the tax component here. And you mentioned it would be a tax on Wall Street on transactions. Now, many Americans, actually most Americans now, have their retirement savings in 401k plans or other private instruments. So in a way, wouldn't a tax on Wall Street be a tax on the retirement savings of Americans from all walks of life?
I think that's exactly right. This will end up hurting those Americans who are making good financial decisions. And we certainly don't want to be discouraging those families who have put money away and who have put away a significant amount of savings. This tax is also not expected to generate as much revenue as Senator Sanders has proposed that it would. I'm not a tax policy expert myself, but here at the Heritage Foundation, we have written on the fact that these types of taxes increase market volatility, they hurt traders, and like I mentioned, don't raise as much revenue as projected in these types of proposals. So these types of taxes not only hurt the economy, but they don't cover the cost that this massive federal undertaking would take to pay for not only forgiving loans, but also providing college tuition free.
And looking at that component of it, the paying of all college tuition free going forward, would not that be a prescription for really sending the cost through the roof? Because if it's free, quote, free, because somebody's actually paying for it, but if it's free to the student, wouldn't that encourage more people to go into these colleges and universities, perhaps folks who really would be better off pursuing other avenues in their life?
Yeah, so not even taking into account the uptick in enrollment that we would inevitably see once college is tuition-free. But we have long argued here at the Heritage Foundation that the evidence is pretty clear that easy access to federal student loans is the reason we've seen college tuition skyrocket in recent decades. When they have a virtually blank check from Washington, schools have no incentive to keep their prices low because they know students aren't being price sensitive and they know that the federal government will come in and provide loans to make up that difference. I said virtual blank check which is what we have right now, that check won't become virtual. It will become an actuality. It will be a complete blank check to these universities if we offer college tuition free. And so that gives them free rein to jack up prices for American taxpayers who will have to be paying for it in the long run. And so it's simply not worth it for us to be providing college tuition free, given the effects that it will have on damaging the quality of education inevitably, and the effects that it will have on the economy.
There's also concern that is growing that our system of colleges and universities, Mary Claire, are educating students for professions and for jobs that simply do not exist, and that we have jobs in the trades, in the manufacturing sector, that are going unfilled because there are not qualified workers. If we were to make four-year college degrees something that was paid for totally by the federal government, wouldn't that just make that problem even worse, because young people would have the avenue of just simply going into college and having a four-year free ride to do whatever they want?
It would certainly make the problem worse. And I think that discussions about free college get us away from the conversation that we should be having, which is, does everyone need to go to college, and what alternatives to the traditional college education can we bolster in our society that would get students from high school to work as fast and as cheap as possible? And I think that very few people would argue that the modern system of higher education that we have today is the most efficient way that we can be training our workforce. I think it's wildly inefficient. And it doesn't take into account, you know, the loans that you take out, you know, where you want to go or what you want to study. I think we should be thinking about college alternatives. I think we should be making it easier for new providers to come in and say, hey, I can train you to do this for X, you know, profession. I can do it much cheaper than a bachelor's degree school can, and I can do it in half the time. I think we have many types of institutions that could be able to do that if they were able to compete in this market space, but they simply can't with the amount of federal money we have in the system.
And given the amount of money that we have in the federal system already, and if we were to, and I don't believe the senator's plan is likely to ever come to fruition, but were it to do so, would this simply not give colleges and universities a blank check to continue what's already a trend toward overbuilding, not only in terms of overstaffing, but their physical plants? A lot of these colleges have turned into Taj Mahals. This would just be more fodder for that, would it not?
Oh, certainly. We've seen a massive administrative bloat at our college and universities. We've also seen a facilities arms race, if you will, where, you know, each university has to build bigger and better athletic facility to attract students, that they don't go to the school down the street that has an even more attractive, you know, athletic program, you know, say, things like that. All of these things that don't focus on the academics themselves. So we've already seen schools move away from academics to, you know, more and more trivial factors that go into one's college experience. I think that will be made 10 times worse if we free college come in, because, again, students won't be price sensitive to it. They'll simply be sending the check to the American taxpayers, who unfortunately will be forced to pay it under this plan.
We have been talking with Mary Claire Amsalem, who is a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Mary Claire, tell us just a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Also, what is the website where folks can go to read more about this topic?
The Heritage Foundation is a public policy research think tank located in Washington, D.C. We are dedicated to principles of free markets and individual liberty, things like that. You can find more about the Heritage Foundation at heritage.org.
Mary Claire Amsalem of the Heritage Foundation. Mary Claire, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on everything happening in Washington, D.C. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
President Trump, Scott, of course, is continuing to try to bring about reforms to the health care system in the absence of any significant congressional action. He took a major step this past week. What occurred?
On Monday, President Trump tried to attack one of the biggest issues related to health care, and that's price transparency. The president issued a new executive order that hopefully will improve price and quality transparency, and this is delivering on his promise to pretty much tell American patients that we're going to give you price competition and options when you're shopping around for health insurance. So what happened was the Department of Health and Human Services is now requiring hospitals to publicly disclose amounts that reflect what people will actually pay for services in an easy-to-read format. And this is really empowering patients with information. Right now, our healthcare system has really hidden the true costs of what health insurance is for the American people by keeping critical information away from patients and limiting overall competition in the healthcare marketplace. So what the president is doing is bringing about transparency that we believe will lower costs, and this is a real, real big issue here. I think that there may be some health insurance companies that have been loading up large profits, and there may be hospitals that would prefer to deal directly with the health insurer than the patient. But overall, this is great for the individual American, and the executive order is just going to make a big difference, we think, in the overall cost of health insurance.
So the president making progress on transparency. We are, however, awaiting some significant action, hopefully, by the courts, and that is scheduled for July. What is queued up to be litigated here in July?
Winding back a little bit to earlier this year, the Northern District Court in Texas found that the individual mandate being zeroed out in tax reform made the entire Obamacare law unconstitutional. And when they did that, there was obviously an appeal, and that is now residing in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which means that oral arguments will be starting next month. And if we can continue to go on this path that Obamacare is unconstitutional because there's no tax related to the individual mandate, if you recall, that's how Chief Justice Roberts really kept the law intact in 2012. So this is an opportunity for the entire law to be scrapped, eventually making its way up to the Supreme Court. So what's important is for conservatives, for President Trump, for Republicans that have promised for a decade to get at the real drivers of costs in the health insurance market, to come up with a replacement plan. And so that's what Club for Growth is working on right now with some of our friends in Congress. We're working on free market reforms that will dramatically increase choice and competition and lower healthcare premiums especially. So it's largely about deregulation in the health insurance market, giving people the option to purchase health insurance across state lines. But of course, what we need to do is be a little bit patient and see exactly what happens in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then eventually the Supreme Court. Meantime, if Congress swings back to a Republican majority in the House, then we would have a Republican House, Republican Senate, and hopefully a reelection of President Trump. They could certainly give it another go at that point. I know that President Trump wants Republican Party to be the party of health care, so let's show our money and put our cards on the table, go all in, and try to win this issue.
Republicans have really been hurt politically by the health care issue in recent election cycles, Scott. Is this an opportunity for the president to reframe the debate and Republicans to reclaim the issue?
I think it is, actually. It is a top issue for Democrat voters, and we've seen that in the debates this week as well. I know we're going to talk about that in a second. But health insurance is an issue that Republicans largely wanted to kind of keep on the back burner in the 2018 elections, while Democrats were out there talking about all the failures that Republicans had. So they're making it a top issue. I definitely think that immigration is the top issue right now in our country, but health insurance is going to be a big one for the election in 2020.
Speaking of immigration, there has been somewhat of a gridlock over the past couple weeks between Congress and the president over particularly the need to provide additional humanitarian aid. Can you frame that discussion for us?
Yeah, so what we had here was pretty much dueling proposals within the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. In the House of Representatives, there was legislation proposed by Nancy Pelosi that was overwhelmingly supported by the Democrats in their majority, but no Republicans supported it. Actually, I shouldn't say no. I think that three voted for it. And then in the Senate, you had real bipartisan legislation with over 80 votes to pass a $4.6 billion emergency spending bill related to the humanitarian efforts on border security down there on our southern border. So we've had these dueling bills, a resolution on the issue leading up to the 4th of July recess. So it's been really capturing all of Washington's attention. I know that many of your listeners saw the picture of the little girl and the father that drowned over the past week. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking. I think that it really is an issue that we need to address, and the best way to do that is by beefing up our border security, being clear to those that want to come here that there's a legal process. We're a generous nation that invites over 1 million people to come into our country every year. Just do it the legal way. Otherwise, you're endangering your family and your friends.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. So, Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 250,000 members from all across the country, including all 50 states in the union. Our organization is united because we believe in economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested, they can check us out on our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can actually become a member of the Club for Growth for free. I'd also encourage everybody to check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you next week.
Thank you.
Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine recently sat down with U.S. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, and they talked about a number of issues, including potential regulations on big tech firms and the worsening situation with Iran. Eric?
Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. You're listening to American Radio Journal. Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to sit down with Senator Ron Wyden. He's a Democrat from Oregon, but he's not really your typical Democrat. During his long, more than two decades in the Senate, he's earned a reputation for working across the aisle with Republicans on a number of issues, and he, even by his own admission, has libertarian chromosomes in his blood. Most recently, he's worked with Senator Rand Paul on trying to rein in domestic surveillance. He's also an outspoken critic of wars in the Middle East, wars that have been conducted under presidential administrations on both sides of the Republican-Democrat line. He's one of the more interesting characters in Congress. So I wanted to sit down with Senator Wyden this week to talk about two very important issues that are in the news. We talked about the ongoing tensions in the Middle East and President Donald Trump's claim that he could go to war with Iran without congressional authorization. But first, we talked about this new push that is emerging somewhat surprisingly on the right to regulate big tech, to regulate companies like Google and Facebook, and perhaps force them to submit to some sort of government check to make sure they're acting with political neutrality. This is something that's very important to Senator Wyden because all the way back in 1996, when the internet was just a little infant, he was the author of what's known now as Section 230. It's a part of the Communications Decency Act, and it's specifically the part of that law that guarantees that internet publishers will not be subject to government regulation. It's as important as the First Amendment is to free speech. It's basically the thing that guarantees free speech online. So we started the interview by talking about this claim that's now being made on the right that Section 230 somehow requires websites to be politically neutral. And here's what Senator Wyden had to say about that.
230 has nothing to do with neutrality. Nothing. Zip. No weight to that argument. What 230 was about was saying, hey, look, if you got a conservative blogger, conservative, you know, website, have at it. Your point of view gets out into the marketplace where users and consumers will make judgments about it. And if on the other side of the coin you want to run a liberal site, a liberal platform, website, what have at it as well. And that's what the debate is all about. Nowhere, nowhere at all in Section 230 is there anything resembling some kind of argument about neutrality. It's about making sure that all the voices get heard. And I will tell you that my judgment is that Section 230 is about the most libertarian law on the books. What it means is that customers, users, you name it, decide whether to use or fund a platform. The government doesn't make that decision. That's what these big government conservatives want to change, and for the life of me, I can't understand how this has become a big part of a political party that used to believe in less government and now wants to barrel ahead with the private sector being pushed to the sidelines so that government can call the shots.
There's this other distinction, Senator, that's being made now. And again, we hear this primarily coming from certain factions on the right, this idea that there's a distinction between platforms and publishers online and that they should be regulated differently. Again, is there any basis for that distinction in Section 230 or in the Communications Decency Act more broadly?
No, there is no grounds for that distinction. What this was always about was the little guy. And it arguably is even more important today because as you see concentration in so many areas, be it healthcare, for example, or technology or others, we need an opportunity to encourage the small guy to innovate. That's what 230 did when we began. That's what it's all about now. And if anything, we've seen in the last year that the big guys like of Facebook operated under the theory when we were small, we loved Section 230. And then we got big and powerful. And by God, let's pull up the ladder and say, we don't care so much about this law that helps the little guy. We got ours. And frankly, if somebody rolls back some of Section 230, it helps the big technology people like Facebook hold off small competitors.
You're listening to American Radio Journal. I'm Eric Boehm, and we are talking with Senator Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon. Senator, I want to change gears here. Just a few minutes left in our time together, and I want to ask about something that that President Donald Trump said this week. He said that he believed he could go to war with Iran if necessary without congressional authorization. So sort of a two-pronged question. Do you agree with that assessment? And regardless of whether you agree with it or not, what do you think Congress's role should be here with regard to the kind of the saber rattling and the tensions that are going on really on both sides of the U.S.-Iranian relationship right now?
A, I think he's wrong. B, at a minimum, we ought to have a real debate on the floor of the United States Senate about this rush to war. I was one of 23 in the United States Senate who voted against the Iraq War. And I sure wish that my side had prevailed. And talk about what happens when you don't really think this through. I think that the country learned a lesson with respect to how to handle major international challenges where you're looking at the use of force. And I just hope that that view won't prevail, and the president's position yesterday that he can basically start wars when he feels like it is, in my view, blatantly unconstitutional.
Big thank you to Senator Ron Wyden for letting me sit down with him and answer those, I think, very important questions earlier this week. You can check out more details about that interview in a piece that I wrote at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Iran shot down an American drone, and President Trump has ramped up economic sanctions. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says the president understands how to deal with that rogue regime.
The tensions in the Middle East have been escalating in the past few months. In reality, the tensions have been extraordinarily high in that area for a millennium and for the United States for centuries. The United States Marine Corps hymn starts with the expression, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Tripoli is in the Middle East, and the history of the Marine Corps. First Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon was presented with a Mameluke sword that serves as a Marine Corps officer's sword today. The tensions in the Middle East reflect life in general. The difference today versus the past two decades is that, like President Thomas Jefferson at the time of the Barbary Pirates excursions, we now have a president in Donald Trump who is willing to bring the problem to the forefront and confront it head on. Recently, Iran downed a United States drone and attacked ships in the Gulf of Oman. This is not significantly different than what President Jefferson experienced, except that the lethality of the weapons used today are more severe. President Trump's policies in the Middle East are precisely what is needed at a most critical time. His signaling of his intent to launch strikes against Iran, then reconsidering, and then launching a coordinated sanctions attack reflect a well-thought-out strategy. The president's actions against Iran are an extension of the strategy he employed in his successful campaign against ISIS at the beginning of his administration. Trump's economic sanctions against Iran will have an impact on the Ayatollah's $200 billion portfolio. It will hurt, and it will send him a message. During the Obama administration, bombing a target was considered the strategy. Bombing is a tactic. It's not a strategy. Bombing may make someone feel that they have taken decisive action, but in fact, it shows weakness. Its weakness is that bombing is a discrete operation with no long-term consequences to a people who are willing to fight a war for a millennium. The Trump administration took the bold step of changing direction and providing clear insight to foreign powers that we have a strategic intent and we will protect the strategic intent and our national interests. The Trump administration is aware that an enemy must know that you are serious. The enemy must know you will defend and will go on the offensive. The enemy must have no clue what you would be willing to do to concern to achieve your national interest. The enemy must know that you will use your military and your economic prowess and be prepared to operate using the full spectrum of military and economic forces, from psychological operations to military intervention to economic sanctions. U.S. forces and our president use psychological operations as well as part of a coordinated military and economic campaign. The difference between our use of psychological operations by Trump is that more frequently than not, threats of retaliation by our enemy were just that, threats with little military substance to tip the scales to victory for our enemy. When Iran struck by downing our drone and operating militarily in the Gulf of Oman, Iran departed from its usual rhetoric, which indicated to our president that a much more decisive and unpredictable response from the United States must be undertaken. The president, by threatening to strike militarily, showed intent. By reconsidering, he sent a message of restraint, which gives temporary pause to Iran, and then by striking by force with severe economic sanctions, he continued the economic war that is far more damaging to Iran than any military strike could ever be. The Arabic language is frequently characterized by cultural influences in which assertions of threats or the threats themselves carry as much weight as carrying out the threat. From 1950 to 2001, one would frequently encounter very blustery Arabic threats with a clear understanding that the threat was more psychological than real. Some of the linguistic differences between Arabic and English are presented in an excellent discourse called Arabic Rhetoric, A Pragmatic Analysis. Iran's threats are real, executable, violent, and coordinated. The enemy has adapted to counter our strengths and exploit our weaknesses and must not be taken for granted. Iran's use of psychological operations against Western nations through the downing of a drone, when combined with their relatively effective Gulf of Oman operation, sends messages that Iran is willing to disrupt commerce. Trump just signaled, so are we. The enemy has demonstrated that it will carry out its threats. President Trump has signaled that he will use the full scope of U.S. military and economic might to execute our will. President Trump understands that an enemy is to be defeated, not coddled. President Trump has launched the second salvo in restoring U.S. credibility in the region with his actions. The first salvo was against ISIS, and it was successful. For this administration, the full military and economic arsenal of our nation are available to this president, and he will use them. He's demonstrated that. Iran, be warned. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WKGM-AM, in Smithfield, Virginia. Welcome to our new listeners in the Old Dominion. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.